The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Tuesday, March 12th. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. In tonight's news, Wisconsin Democrats hold a press conference to criticize one of Donald Trump's campaign threats.
Wisconsin continues to face healthcare workforce challenges.
A Dane County Board candidate says it's time to rethink spending practices.
And in the second half, Cardinal Call discusses a controversial Milwaukee Republican with UW ties. Madison Mixology pours a mean Moscow mule, and Wildlife Weekly gets ready for this year's spring migration.
This is Christian Knutson and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
An effort to recall the top Republican in the Wisconsin legislature appears to have come up short, but a final decision could be up to the courts. Organizers hoping to oust Assembly Speaker Robin Voss turned in thousands of petition signatures this week, the Associated Press reports. But the Wisconsin Election Commission said today their initial count shows collectors were at least more than 900 signatures shy of what was needed to trigger a recall election. The matter is complicated by recent changes to the state's voting maps. The process changed the lines of Voss's district. An election commission member said they don't have a final answer on whether signatures should have come from the old or new district. They have asked the state Supreme Court to rule on the issue. The recall effort was organized by supporters of former President Donald Trump, who are angry that Voss didn't push to overturn President Joe Biden's narrow win in Wisconsin in the 2020 election or support impeaching the state's top elections official.
Republicans in the state Senate have fired more of Democratic Governor's Tony Evers' appointees to government agencies, including two regents for the Universities of Wisconsin. The Senate voted to reject eight of Evers' nominations today, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That brings the total to 21 of the governor's appointees that Republicans have fired since he first took office. The UW regents dismissed were John Miller and Dana Walks. The committee did not provide a reason for their dismissal, but Democrats said it was because they voted against a deal that tied UW funding to a Republican demand to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion positions on campuses. Evers has already announced his appointment of two new regents to replace Miller and Walks. Other appointees the committee fired include members of boards dealing with judicial conduct, state employee retirement, and domestic abuse.
The state Senate also moved forward today with a controversial bill restricting transgender participation in high school sports, despite a promise from Governor Tony Evers to veto it. The Republican-supported measure would bar high school athletes from playing on teams that don't match the sex they were assigned at birth. It mirrors similar bans enacted in several other states. But Evers reiterated his promise to veto the bill today, according to the Associated Press, saying he would be, quote, damn proud to do it. The Biden administration is reportedly developing a national policy that would outlaw such blanket restrictions on trans athletes.
Asian American and Hmong history will likely be part of the curriculum in K-12 classrooms across Wisconsin. A bipartisan plan adding Asian American and Hmong history to the state's list of required school topics passed the state Senate today and is on its way to the governor's desk for signature. Assembly Representative Francesca Hong, a Democrat from Madison and one of the bill's backers, celebrated the news in a tweet. Hong wrote that she was, quote, speechless and in tears, unquote, adding that it will be the first time many children will see themselves represented in the classroom. Wisconsin already requires schools to teach Native American, Black, and Latino history.
Madison police plan to crack down on traffic violations in 2024 with a specific focus on pedestrian and bicycle laws. City police plan to use state transportation funding to step up enforcement efforts, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The department did not provide specifics on what infractions it is targeting, but said the goal is to improve safety for pedestrians and cyclists. The MPD is also working with the Dane County Sheriff's Office this year to enforce seatbelt, alcohol, and speeding laws.
Packer to Jet to Veep. NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers has reportedly been in conversation with independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. about being his running mate for the White House, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Off the field, Rodgers has been a vocal detractor of the COVID-19 vaccine and a critic of President Joe Biden's stances that line up with Kennedy's. But even if Rodgers is chosen for that ticket, it's unlikely the Super Bowl champion would score an electoral W in November. As with most independent bids, Kennedy's candidacy is likely a Hail Mary. And those were the headlines. Now on to the rest of today's top stories.
State Democratic lawmakers held a press conference outside the Wisconsin State Capitol today to rally around President Joe Biden. They highlighted the importance of Social Security and Medicare after Republican candidate Donald Trump implied yesterday he would consider making cuts to the programs. WRT News producer Faye Parks was at today's press conference.
Donald Trump has once again proclaimed his interest in slashing the earned benefit programs that more than a million Wisconsinites rely on. We're here today to make very clear to Donald Trump that folks here in Wisconsin are going to stand and fight for Social Security and Medicare.
That was Ben Wickler, chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, at today's press conference outside the state capitol. He was joined by State Representative Lisa Subek, a Democrat from Madison, and members of the Wisconsin Democratic Seniors Leadership Council. Today's press conference follows a statement Donald Trump made yesterday to a CNBC commentator.
In Trump's own words, he said, "There's a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting. A lot you can do in terms of cutting."
Wickler pointed out that these proposed cuts are unpopular across the political spectrum.
Fox News found that 71% of respondents to their own poll supported the funding of Social Security and Medicare, not the cutting of these earned benefit programs.
The Biden campaign was quick to respond yesterday, issuing a new digital ad criticizing Trump's comments. A Trump spokesperson later told CNN that he was merely talking about cutting waste, and Democrats are misrepresenting his words. But Representative Subek countered that statement today.
Donald Trump's track record here is terrible. He sought to cut Social Security and Medicare every single year while in office, and instead focused on giving tax cuts to corporations and to his rich friends.
According to Subek, more than 1.2 million Wisconsinites rely on Social Security benefits, and more than 1.3 million rely on Medicare.
These programs help them make ends meet, and it helps them afford the health care coverage that they need so that they can access the care they need to live well into their retirement and enjoy that retirement.
Ellen Holly, co-chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Seniors Leadership Council in Walworth County, also spoke at today's press conference, drawing on personal experience.
When you're 16 years old, retirement seems forever away, and gosh darn it, you want all of that money right now. 50 years later, my earned benefits in Social Security and Medicare have allowed me to stay safely and happily in my home and to afford my prescription medication.
Top Democrats chose to give a press conference outside, even as the Republican-led state Senate wrapped up their final business before adjourning for the year. One high-profile item that moved through the state Senate today, a bill that would ban trans girls from participating in their high school's girls' sports teams. The bill already passed through the state assembly last fall and heads now to the desk of Governor Evers, who today renewed his promise to veto the bill, reports the Associated Press. According to State Dems Chair Ben Wickler, this bill and others targeting the LGBTQIA+ community are merely a conservative tactic to drum up support.
There's a clear Republican agenda to instill panic among parents and folks across Wisconsin and across the country in order to gain electoral advantage.
The presidential drum up comes as President Biden is slated to make a campaign stop in Milwaukee tomorrow, 3 weeks ahead of Wisconsin's presidential primary. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
Healthcare employers continue to highlight staffing challenges across the country, including here in Wisconsin. Newly released data confirms lingering concerns. Those behind the report say if the state wants to be able to care for an aging population, it has to show real progress in hiring. Wisconsin News Connection's Mike Moen has the story.
Critical but stable. That's how an industry group describes the state of Wisconsin's healthcare workforce. Amid some brighter spots, shortages loom large in the face of an aging population. Annual findings from the Wisconsin Hospital Association show that health systems around the state have made some hiring gains following some worrisome years. However, job vacancy rates are at double digits for 8 of the 18 health professions detailed in the new report, and registered nurses just moved into that territory. WHA's Ann Zink says that's concerning for a key reason.
Registered nurses make up over half of the hospital and health system workforce. So that's very impactful because nurses can fill other gaps on the healthcare team.
The industry faces these headwinds, with Wisconsin projected to see one out of every four residents reach retirement age by 2030, putting more pressure on demand for services. Providers and state officials are carrying out efforts to reduce staffing turnover in healthcare. However, the report has specific recommendations, including regulatory changes and expanded use of technology to help see patients. In the meantime, Zeng says the current challenges will be noticed by healthcare consumers.
People have to wait longer for a primary care appointment or a specialty appointment. Sometimes they end up needing to come to an urgent care department or an emergency department to get that access.
Zeng says that creates busier waiting rooms for those settings. And the report's authors say clinics are having a harder time filling certain support staff positions, such as medical assistants and receptionists. As for the bright spots, the WHA says there are more physicians in Wisconsin than there were a decade ago. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In just 3 weeks, Dane County voters will once again decide who sits on the county board. Two candidates are vying for the District 9 seat, which represents Madison's far west side. John Walliger is running against incumbent supervisor Stephen Peters. They'll face off on April 2nd. Earlier today, Walliger spoke to WRT News producer Faye Parks to discuss his priorities for the district.
Thank you for joining me, John.
Nice to be here.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what inspired you to run for the Dane County Board?
I'm an orthopedic surgeon, and I have worked at UW-Madison until last year when I semi-retired, and I continue to work part-time at the VA hospital and in Sauk Prairie Hospital. I've been in Dane County for about 30 years, and I really love living here. And now that I'm not working as much and my kids are out of the house, I feel like I can give back to the community and participate in civic activities.
So do you have any kind of background in politics?
I don't. I've been involved, you know, in committees and setting policy and at the hospital level. I'm currently in charge of the orthopedic department at the VA hospital, which I have to work with our staff in terms of just keeping things organized and running smoothly, as well as organizing other people to come and fill in and work. I've worked in other committees where we look at finance and compensation, other ones that look at buying equipment, so some financial decisions that the hospitals have had to make. So I have some experience both with looking at financial decisions as well as personnel decisions.
What are your priorities for District 9? What changes would you like to see there?
I'm not sure I can say for specifically for District 9. I'm more interested at the county level, and I think the spending is the big thing that I am concerned about. I see the budget increasing at a pretty rapid rate, and with that, taxes and debt going up, and I feel like we need to have a little more fiscal responsibility. And so I'd like to just put my voice toward making sure that we're spending all the taxpayers' money responsibly and not getting ourselves into trouble with debt.
Are there specific areas you think need to be trimmed or potentially cut in order to save taxpayer money?
I would say at this point, I don't have enough knowledge to say anything specific. The budget is hundreds of pages long, and I have not read through the entire thing. I don't know if there's a specific place that I would aim to cut. I think that sometimes the approach, instead of cutting an entire department or something like that, which is fairly drastic and probably a mistake, is more looking at trying to say, can everybody cut back 1% to 2% on the budget across the board and just prevent us from needing to spend more every year?
I know that criminal justice reform is a big talking point this year. What is your perspective on that?
One of the other times I've talked about this, I think there's a big overlap between mental illness, substance abuse, and criminal behavior. And I think we need to separate those things out so that we're not using the criminal justice system to try to treat some of those other problems. And I think we need to focus on treatment, especially for people with mental illness or substance abuse, and that treatment should come first. I think there's elements that are just criminals, and I think that we need to have a jail so that we can treat those people according to the law. But I think the critical thing is trying to tease out where someone would benefit more from treatment rather than jailing them.
And another big topic of conversation this year is affordable housing, just generally across the county. Do you have any ideas about that, any solutions you'd propose if elected?
Yeah, that is a really difficult question. Some of that we can't control. Obviously, if you just look at supply and demand, Dane County is a great place to live. So a lot of people want to live here. And so it makes housing, there's a high demand for housing. And then there has to be a supply to match that, which is sometimes difficult to get. That's going to drive up prices. I don't think that the county can do a lot to fix that. They're not going to build houses. They have to get someone to do that. I think the only thing that can really be controlled by the county is property taxes. And by trying, again, when I talk about the fiscal responsibility, part of that is trying to keep property taxes lower. They've been going up at a fairly dramatic pace, I think 14% this year alone. And trying to keep that portion under control is the best thing that the county can do to try to help with housing costs.
So meanwhile, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is around the corner. What are your thoughts on that race? And if elected to the county board, how do you plan to handle that transition?
Well, I know that the board and the executive don't necessarily work arm in arm. They're sort of two separate branches. So I don't really know that I have much to say about the county executive race. Or at least I certainly have no influence on it. And so I hope that whoever is elected there is someone who's interested in working with the board.
So I think that covers all of my questions, but is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I think that this is kind of exciting because in 27 of the 37 county board seats are running unopposed. Voters have a choice between two people for a change, the way I think the election should run. So I'm hoping that that's a positive thing and something that other districts can try to mimic in the future.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, John.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
That was John Wallager, one of two candidates vying for the District 9 seat, representing Madison's far west side on the Dane County Board. Wallager says, if elected to the county board, he will look for ways to trim the county's budget and, in turn, lower property taxes for Dane County residents. We'll hear from his opponent, incumbent Stephen Peters, later this week. The two of them will face off on April 2nd.
Which actions can help benefit the climate the most? A new online tool can show you. En-ROADS helps communities understand which policies are most effective for climate action. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz of Yale's Climate Connection has the details.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Setting clean energy goals, pledging to plant billions of trees, mandating energy efficiency improvements. Lots of policies can reduce global warming, and it can be hard to know which are the most effective. So Climate Interactive and the MIT Sloan Sustainability Initiative created a free online simulation tool called En-ROADS.
To help people understand what policies are available and what kind of impact that they will have in terms of achieving desired climate goals.
Michael Overend, a volunteer with the nonprofit Citizens Climate Lobby, leads community workshops using En-ROADS. Users choose from a menu of climate policies, such as charging carbon polluters a fee or subsidizing EV purchases, and they can tweak variables like the amount charged on a ton of carbon. The tool provides instant feedback on how those policies would affect global temperature, sea level rise, and other outcomes if they were implemented worldwide.
It can be used to spark discussion among our leadership. It can be used to help educate community members.
And inform action on the path toward a safer future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to everyone who donated during our winter pledge drive. You keep the microphones on.
Next up is Cardinal Call, a segment featuring news about UW-Madison from the Daily Cardinal student newspaper. This week, host Oliver Gerhars talks with the Daily Cardinal's campus news editor, Liam Barron, about Gerard Randall, a Republican official from Milwaukee with ties to UW-Madison, who recently was involved in a high-profile business scandal.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your weekly dose of UW-Madison campus news from the Daily Cardinal student newspaper. I'm your host, Oliver Gerhars. Following a report from Wisconsin Public Radio in November of last year, Gerard Randall, a top Wisconsin GOP official, resigned from his position in the 2024 Republican National Convention Host Committee following a high-profile business scandal. However, Randall continues to influence budgets and serve at the UW-Madison's Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership. Today we're joined by the Daily Cardinal's campus news editor, Liam Barron, to discuss the scandal and Randall's current role at the center. Liam, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Oliver.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the scandal involving Gerard?
Gerard Randall is the executive director and sole employee of Milwaukee Education Partnership, which is a nonprofit that aims to increase educational outcomes for students in Milwaukee. He came under some fire after a November 2023 joint report from WPR and Wisconsin Watch by one of the reporters, Corinne Hess, outlined that Randall's nonprofit had some contracts, no-bid contracts, that were fulfilled with either really vague services that some school board members found redundant or were incomplete. After that reporting, the Milwaukee Public School District later cut their contracts with Randall, and he would later resign at the end of the month as the RNC host committee secretary.
And what does it mean when a contract is no bid?
So a no bid contract is meant for specialized services that wouldn't be duplicated with other partners. It means that other people who would typically bid for the contract wouldn't. It's a non-competitive bidding process. And through no bid contracts, Randall's nonprofit received $1.2 million from 2012 until 2023.
What was Randall's role on the 2024 RNC Host Committee?
Yeah, so Randall was the RNC Host Committee secretary for the July 2024 RNC, which will be in Milwaukee. He was appointed by Cavalier Johnson, the mayor of Milwaukee. It's unclear. The RNC didn't really provide an explanation for why Randall resigned. Randall didn't provide comment to WPR or Wisconsin Watch or to me. So the reasons for resignation are unclear, but he was the host committee secretary and resigned on November 30th, 2023.
So what is UW-Madison's Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership? And also, who is Tommy G. Thompson?
Tommy G. Thompson is a former governor of Wisconsin, a Republican. He is also a former UW system president. And the Tommy G. Thompson Center was created by the state legislature and specifically spearheaded by Republicans in 2017 to be a center for public leadership. It's been described by some as a think tank. They distribute grants. They host events. They spend at least $500,000 a year to invite speakers all around public leadership and how to improve public leadership in Wisconsin. Or their public leadership board is made of some notable former conservative leaders. And there are some concerns about the partisan bend of the center, which is technically nonpartisan in legislative language, but is considered to have a sort of conservative angle.
So what does Randall do on the board of that center?
Yeah, so Randall would be one of seven people on the board. That's including Alexander Talk, who's the Thompson Center director, who has a position on the board. And so Randall would be part of the committee that votes on expenditures, increasing scholarships, for example, or inviting certain speakers, speaker expenditures, eventual review reports of the Thompson Center director, and generally the sort of big picture administrative decisions that go on the Thompson Center, specifically related to budgets.
So he's got a permanent term on that board, yes?
Yes, that's correct. Certain board members have a three-year term. So those appointed by Assembly Speaker, those appointed by the Senate Majority Leader, and then those who served previously under Tommy G. Thompson have three-year terms, whereas the director and a delegate of the Tommy Thompson Charitable Foundation have permanent terms. And so Randall is the designee of the Thompson Family Charitable Foundation's president, which is former Governor Tommy Thompson. And that means that he's serving a permanent term unlike the other three-year board appointees.
So the concern here is that a similar scandal to the one that happened with Milwaukee Education Partnership has the potential to happen with the Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership as long as Gerard Randall is on that board.
Yeah, that's the concern I heard from Senator Kelda Royce, who is a member of the state legislature's budget writing committee, as well as a student De La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. They're concerned about accountability and the fact that Randall could pose a lingering risk given his past sort of controversies. And, you know, the board, the public leadership board, does have a decent amount of control over the Thompson Center's budgets and what stuff is spent on.
A good portion of your article was looking at what the responses of other members of the board. I mean, they got back to you with some pretty lukewarm answers, I would say. Has anyone else responded to you?
So Alexander Talk, the center's director, responded to me. And Scott Jensen, a board member, also responded to me. None of the other five board members had any response. And the two responses that I got were essentially, we appreciate Randall's service. No one made a specific comment on the potential for resignation.
So it's fairly unclear what the procedure for removal would be.
Yeah, I mean, the public leadership board at the Thompson Center, it's not like other boards that you'd find at UW-Madison. For example, like academic staff executive committee or a committee on the Wisconsin Union. This is a board that's created through legislative action by the state legislature. And to my knowledge, it would be dictated by the statutes that the legislature put forth, 36.68. But there's not an indication of in there of how a removal would work.
So as the designee, would the decision pretty much fall on Tommy Thompson?
This is also something that's not specifically enumerated in legislative language, but were Tommy Thompson to designate someone else, I suppose they would be the new designee of the Thompson Charitable Foundation.
Thanks for coming on this week, Liam.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Oliver.
In other campus news, UW-Madison's police department released a statement on February 20th warning students about online scams targeting international students. The scams typically include a phone call from someone fluent in Chinese impersonating a fictional landlord, the police, or a government official. International students should be wary of anyone calling with news too good to be true about housing, immigration, or taxes. In other campus news, UW-Madison will be extending its commitment deadline for incoming students to May 15th instead of the usual May 1st. This decision comes in light of the 2024-25 FAFSA, or the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, rolling out 3 months later than usual for students, meaning that UW-Madison will not be receiving the form until sometime in March. In more campus news, UW-Madison is planning to add a bronze plaque to the Van Hise Hall lobby explaining the university's history of eugenics. The plaque will describe the complicated legacy of early 20th century UW President Charles Van Hise, in the context of his support for eugenics and forced sterilization. The plaque does not intend to be a bandage for the issue, but the starting point for a conversation.
Get your copper mugs ready. In this slightly belated edition of Madison Mixology, Charlie Belosky explores the murky, uncertain origins of a popular cocktail, the Moscow Mule, and he'll tell us how to make one, too.
Welcome back to Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite reporter, Charlie Belosky. Today, I will be showing you how to make the Moscow Mule, and we'll go into more detail about the copper cup it's served in. Smirnoff is at it again. With drinks like the screwdriver bringing attention to vodka in the United States, the Moscow Mule found rapid success. The 1940s were a marketing dream for the vodka company, and today's drink starts with the CEO of the company that owns Smirnoff, John G. Martin. Martin purchased the U.S. rights and license from a guy called Rudolf Kunet in 1938, who himself had purchased it from the Smirnoff family. Kunet then introduced Martin to Jack Morgan, the owner of the Cock and Bull, a prominent bar in Los Angeles. It was there in California, not Russia, that the first Moscow Mule would be created. Martin decided that the best way to make a name for themselves in the American market would be to introduce vodka as a mixer, similar to whiskey. Jack Morgan was having issues selling his Cock and Bull ginger beer to Americans as well. Most preferred ginger ale for its sweetness. With help from the Cock and Bull's bartender, a man named Wes Price, they decided to try their hand at a vodka and ginger beer cocktail, more to clear out the cases upon cases of ingredients that were taking up space in their back room at the bar than to invent a new drink. It turned out to be a massive success. To make this drink, you'll need a couple of items. Start with the always important glass and ice cubes. If you have one, a proper copper cup is the traditional way to serve up this drink. From there, start with the liquor and add about 1.5 to 2 ounces of vodka. Then add about 1/2 ounce of lime juice and then finish it off with about 1 ounce of ginger beer. Then it's time to taste your creation. Bottoms up. Wow. Let me tell you, that is zingy. The ginger is very, very powerful in that. And if you combine that with the lime, I don't know, it amplifies the sour taste of the lime. Now, it might have been, you know, I took the liberty and added a little bit extra lime juice because I'm a really big fan of citrus, but it reminds me a lot of, believe it or not, the 7 and 7. Like, I know that there's the obvious, like, defining differences between the two, but I think the citrus flavor of the 7-Up is very reminiscent of the burst of lime that you get from this. And the ginger beer is just, it's really interesting. It's very bright, but it's dry. Incredibly complex, too. Like, despite it only being, like, 3 ingredients, the taste is just, I don't know, it's the combination of ginger and lime that just kind of really, it's different, I guess. But it's interesting. It's like an interesting different. It's very tasty. The copper mugs were actually a very interesting story as well. When asked why they were chosen, bartender Wes Price admitted, I think he was quoted with saying something like, oh, you know, like they weren't really for anything in particular. They were only put up to enhance the curiosity of people that saw the drink. There are some people that say that, you know, the copper is bad for you if it's not, like, lined properly. And it's kind of led to a turnoff of some people wanting their Moscow Mules in copper serving devices. But in reality, as long as they're, you know, washed correctly, drinking out of a copper cup isn't going to kill you. Where the copper mugs came from is also a topic that's heavily debated as well. What's not debated is the fact that there was a woman at the Cock and Bull with these 4 gentlemen while they were creating this beverage. The identity of the woman is a debated topic, though. It's one of 2 women. The first woman is a lady by the name of Oseline Schmidt. She was the daughter of German immigrants and apparently had inherited her father's copper factory, but was struggling to sell the products. And she had been basically going from bar to bar to try to find people to sell these copper mugs to. And she just so happened to coincidentally be in the Cock and Bull at the exact same time that these dudes were making this Moscow Mule beverage. And she kind of came in. She was like, why don't you serve them up in these? I think it'd be pretty cool. It'd make a good novelty. And the rest from there is history. The other name that some people believe this woman to have is Sophie Berezinski. She was a Russian immigrant whose father owned the Moscow Copper Company and sent her to the U.S. with a couple thousand mugs to sell. She was kind of in the same boat as Oseline Schmidt. She was going around from bar to bar. She didn't know where to go and eventually ended up in the Cock and Bull at the same time that these drinks were being concocted. The men in the bar credit this mystery woman for her integral role in helping define the Moscow Mule, and they all agree that her name was Oseline, despite there not being any records saying that a woman named Oseline Schmidt existed at the time. There's over 30 different types of mules that were invented and created and formed after the Moscow Mule was formed, and some of these mules have different types of alcohol. Others have different types of garnishes. Others still even come in different types of cups. Like there's the Kentucky Mule that uses bourbon, the Minnesota Mule, the Jamaican Mule that uses rum. There's a wide list. The Moscow Mule has probably the richest history of any drink that I've made so far, like much more than what I can fit into the time of my segment. I would highly recommend learning more about this amazing beverage. But that's all the time that I have today, though. So I am your host, Charlie Bielowski, and I want to thank you for listening to another installment of Madison Mixology.
On this edition of Wildlife Weekly, feature contributor Jackie Sandberg gives us the rundown on spring migration.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I want to talk about the timing of the spring bird migration. And maybe we want to talk about more than just the spring migration, but I want to focus on it today because we are seeing what we feel like is an early spring migration. And as rehabilitators, we have to be adaptable to different changes that happen with different species and the timing that they're arriving in our areas, especially when we live in a northern latitude where birds are constantly migrating further north to go towards Canada or to the Arctic. And then again, in the fall, they're moving south for their wintering grounds. So right now we are in a period of time where it is early spring. Early spring is great because we love seeing the different migrating species through, like red-winged blackbirds, which are already here in Madison. But we are also very concerned when we see that these species maybe are showing up at times that might be a little too early for food availability and for their species. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what phenology is. Phenology is the study of periodic events in the biological life cycles of animals, for example, and how these are influenced by seasonal and interannual variations in climate and habitat factors. So that's the technical definition, which is great, and it has been studied for a very long time. You can go back to the bird phenology program in the North American states, and it stretches back to 1880s, according to climate.gov, who has a really great article on this. And there is data, observation kept by citizen scientists, so people just like yourselves listening to the radio here, who might get involved with tracking birds and when they first arrive at certain locations. So something like eBird is a really great citizen science program that so many birders use. And you could just sit at your window in your kitchen watching your bird feeder and be able to participate in that kind of science. So when you see that first warbler show up in the spring every year at your, you know, backyard, beautiful branched out trees, you can say, oh my gosh, this year it was here 2 weeks earlier than it was last year. While that's great, it's really cool, it's not actually very good when we're starting to see some concerning patterns. And Audubon.org, so the National Audubon Society, just put out an article in the last couple of days talking about migrating birds, and they really stress that the timing for them is so important, and every species is different. So we have some species that are called short distance migrants, and they might be able to hop from one place to another in a very brief period of time. So something like a phoebe, for example, or a cardinal, or maybe a mourning dove, or even red-tailed hawks are considered somewhat short distance migrants. Now, not all of them, but some of them. So they might move, you know, 10 miles, 20 miles in a day or something like that. That would be more for like a red-tailed hawk who averages about 10 miles a day. They might move and be able to very quickly be able to adapt to the current surroundings and the changes happening on more of a local level. Now, if you contrast that to species that are going all the way down to South America and back every single year, twice a year, right? Those are the species that you really worry about. So they say that, you know, if you're a bird wintering in South America, you don't really have an understanding or ability to know if it's early spring or late spring in North America when you get there. And they are saying, based on some research that has recently been published, that those birds are falling behind. And that's a quote from the Audubon. So they're not necessarily able to find a source of food, maybe not even survive their journeys, or they might have less and less babies when they arrive to their summer grounds where they would have their nests and they would be able to lay eggs. So the new study that came out where this really stimulated this article to be published said that the 150 different bird species that were analyzed with the different migratory routes, which there are four different flyways in North America, and we are in the Midwest flyway, but from everything from what they say is hawks to hummingbirds that breed in North America, the green up this spring is earlier, and that's from data that was at least, shouldn't say this year, but this year it is definitely earlier. You're seeing buds out, you're already seeing the trees start to kind of start to sprout, you're seeing green grass. Satellite observations and imagery from 2002 to 2021 were analyzed and says, yes, indeed, the spring is earlier in our area, and that is scary. So the green up is happening earlier and earlier, and that means that there is a rapidly changing climate that birds might not be able to adapt to because they might not be that flexible of a species. And the hard part is that a lot of those birds have either learned over time, so sometimes through multiple generations of birds learning about where to migrate to or when to migrate, or we could have some that are more just dependent on the changes in light. So when we think about daylight savings time, which just happened, those birds see, and although they don't practice the same daylight savings time that we do, you know, they're going to be looking at the biannual patterns of how the light changes in spring and fall to potentially time their migration. And that's just ingrained in their genetics. And so if they just go based on what time of year, calendar year, that light has changed, and they're like, yep, it's about springtime, and that's been something over multiple generations of behavior, they show up and they've missed spring. They've missed the bugs, they've missed the green leaves, they've missed all of the things that they potentially need to survive, and that can be such a struggle. And now the report says that approximately one in every five migrating bird species is now at risk to extinction because of this change. So I think it's important to talk about, not just because this is a great radio segment to talk about wildlife and about the environment. It's something that as rehabilitators, we have to continue documenting our data on when babies are being born, when that timing changes, when they first arrive to our wildlife rehabilitation centers, when one becomes sick or injured or something happens to their parents. Those baby birds come straight to a rehabilitator that helps hand rear them back to the point where they can be re-released. But we also see so many adults that come in during the migration period that are starving, they're underconditioned, maybe they're sick because they're stressed based on the new climate conditions that they've arrived to. So we may see an increase in rehabilitation pressure for these animals, whether they're adults or babies, or maybe we'll see fewer birds altogether. It's something that I think our data sets as rehabilitators can be incredibly crucial from a scientific perspective to actually look at some of these changes and supplement the data that's known already. And this year, we are concerned that it's going to be even earlier than the last couple of years. We'll have to see what changes, and we're definitely kind of on edge thinking about that. So as people out there continue to talk about climate, talk about the changes that are happening, trying to, you know, do what we can to help make the environment a better place for all living things, not just humans, but birds and other animals, definitely support rehabilitation activities because we're here working without any kind of funding. It's just based on our own want to help in the community. It's all private donations, and it's not something we get paid to do. It's not something we can charge services for, but we want to help those wild animals. So be on the lookout for the animals, support your local rehabilitators, support climate initiatives and helping the environment, and know that we're here to help if you need anything in terms of wildlife rehab services. So our center at Dane County Humane Society can be reached at 608-287-3235, or you can check out our website at www.giveshelter.org. Thanks for listening today about bird phenology and the timing of our spring migration. Hopefully you have a great rest of your day. It is beautiful outside. And thanks for listening here on WORT. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was John Klein Wilson.
Thank you to Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz of Yale's Climate Connections.
And special thanks to feature contributors Jackie Sandberg, Oliver Gerhardts, and Charlie Bilowski.
Dave Lawrenson engineered this show.
Faye Parks produces newscast.
And Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Up next is Spanish Language News with Inuit Show Patio. Good night.